and welcome to a new year of On Iowa Politics. This is the January 2nd, 2015 podcast. I'm James Lynch of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. With me today are Christinia Crippas of the Waterloo Courier. Good morning, Christinia.
Good morning, James. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Ed Tibbetts of the Quad City Times. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning and Happy New Year as well.
Likewise. And Aaron Murphy, State House Bureau Chief for Lee Newspapers in Des Moines. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning, James. Happy New Year to everybody.
Thank you. You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and subscribe to On Iowa Politics on iTunes and Stitcher. This week, a look at some of the top political stories of 2014, including the retirement of 30-year U.S. Senator Tom Harkin and the election of the first Iowa woman to Congress. Let's start with Tom Harkin. He surprised, perhaps stunned is a better word to describe his announcement that he would retire rather than seek a sixth term in the U.S. Senate. A lot of us had looked at Harkin as a senator for life, but apparently he thought otherwise and has chosen to continue his advocacy for disability rights and a host of other issues as a private citizen through his Harkin Institute at Drake University. There are a number of angles to this story, and we'll talk about some of them. But I think one of the things that has really struck me about Senator Harkin is his service to Iowa and to the country. And I guess I would say, regardless of Harkin's politics, whether you love them or hate them, I think Iowans owe Harkin a thanks for his service, not just 30 years in the Senate and 10 years in the House, but he was a congressional staffer before that, and he served in the U.S. Navy during the Vietnam War era. And in an era of hyper-partisan politics, I think that kind of service is often underappreciated. And Ed, it's not as if Tom Harkin was some backbencher just keeping a seat warm for the past 40 years. His list of legislative accomplishments is impressive, starting with his sponsorship of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I suspect if we looked around our communities, we would be surprised at the number of projects and programs that have Harkin's fingerprints on them. So what's the significance of the loss of Harkin, his legislative agenda, his seniority, and his ability to get things done that came with his longevity in Congress? What's the impact of that?
Well, you know, I think you're right about looking around our communities and finding Harkin's fingerprints. You can probably look at every county in the state and find a school where a Harkin grant has paid for improvements. I think of a nursing school built in Davenport just a few years ago, built in large part with money he helped secure. But more than just earmarks, I think Tom Harkin's brand of progressivism, his brand of liberalism, is really in the DNA of Iowa Democrats. He didn't invent it, of course, but his long tenure and the fact that he's remained the kind of liberal who believes in using the government to achieve policy goals, chiefly helping people with disabilities and the disadvantaged, is really part of the thinking of activists all over the state. And to the extent that Iowa figures in picking in its party's presidential nominees, that has an impact across the country. That's a pretty big deal. As for the future of the party, we all know that a strong top of the ticket has a huge impact down ballot, and that's an advantage that Democrats have had in one out of every three elections, and now it has to be replaced. Couple that with doubts about who will be the party's next candidate for governor, and you've got some morning clouds for the party. There are other factors, too. We could talk about them all day. Talent attraction. Think about it. How many people who have gone on to great things in national political circles started their own careers with Tom Harkin? That's been a benefit to Iowa Democrats as well.
Yeah. He joked during the campaign that he thinks half the Democrats in Iowa worked on his staff at one time or another, and the list is long and pretty impressive, as you say, Ed. I think people thought they were going to get a similar champion in Bruce Braley, and that didn't work out. Is there a void now in terms of party leadership and someone who, as you described Harkin, was kind of the soul of the party?
Yeah, I'd say there's a void, but voids tend to get filled fairly quickly in politics. Who would have thought that in 2008 that Barack Obama would be the standard bearer for the Democratic Party at the national level for 8 years? I don't think anybody saw that Tom Vilsack was going to be basically the co-leader of the Iowa Democratic Party for the years that he was, not too far in advance of him winning the nomination anyway. So these voids tend to get filled quickly, and you know, it's going to be incumbent upon the Democrats to do that, or don't.
Does anybody have an idea of who that next leader might be, who might step forward to fill that void, or is that one of those things that it will happen and we may not know it until it happens?
I get the sense that we'll know it when we see it. Nobody springs directly to mind for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would agree. I think maybe what the Democrats would tell you right now is that, you know, a year or two ago, who was talking about Joni Ernst as Iowa's next senator? So you never know who can rise to that occasion and fill that void that we're looking for. I don't know that. I don't think, like Christina said, I don't think there's an obvious candidate out there right now.
You know, I think about Tyler Olson's candidacy, brief candidacy for the nomination for governor, and talking about the need to bring in a new era of leadership, definitely an appeal to a younger set. And if it isn't Tyler Olson, you know, I could certainly see somebody coming along from that generation to step forward. Whether they're successful or not, always, you know, hard to tell, but I think of that.
Mm-hmm. And Democrats will be electing a new party chairman here in a week or two, so it'll be interesting to see which way the state central committee goes with that, whether it's a new face or not. On the Republican side, obviously, Joni Ernst is a rising star in the Republican Party in Iowa and perhaps on a broader stage. As you may recall, First District Democrat Bruce Braley was looked at as Harkin's heir apparent and the GOP's so-called A-list of candidates passed on the race. Ernst stepped in, topped a field of five sacrificial lambs, and then went on to defeat Braley, scoring a surprising 8-point victory in the general election. Christina, like the Harkin story, there are a lot of angles to the Joni Ernst story, including a number of firsts. What do you see as the significance of her election?
Well, I think you said it right at the top. I think Iowa has finally broken that glass ceiling of never electing a woman to Congress or to the governor's office. So I think that in itself was fairly historic, and I think, you know, for the country at large, it's a woman who served in a combat role being elected for the first time. But I mean, I think there's more to it than that. You know, she'll be going into a Congress that will be led by Republicans. Iowans will have two Republicans for the first time in quite a while, and I think she has kind of her own unique brand of Republicanism that would make her a distinct voice there. So, you know, like you said, I think that there's several angles, but I think at this point we kind of have to wait and see exactly how she sets herself apart, and I think that she probably will.
We haven't heard a whole lot from Joni Ernst since the election, and she'll be sworn into office next Tuesday, January 6th. And I'm curious how important it'll be what she says that day. She'll be doing a number of media calls and talking to people on the day of her inauguration. And how important is it, the tone she sets and sort of the direction she indicates as she officially starts her career in the Senate?
Well, I think it has potential to like you said, set the tone of how she'll carry herself in the halls of Congress for the next 6 years. But I think it'll be more in action, honestly. I think that, you know, it'll depend on how you see her voting, how you see her introducing things or asking questions in these committee hearings. She made a point of, or her campaign made a point of of criticizing Bruce Braley for not being present at some meetings, and it will be interesting to see how she takes the lead or doesn't in those sorts of situations.
How long will she continue to talk about, we're going to make him squeal? That's what I want to know.
I think only she knows.
Okay. I think that phrase.
You know, Jane,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't know how long the tagline, lasts, but as long as it's working, what the heck, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the advantages she has is that they did during the campaign, the left wasn't able to, I think, among the broader electorate, stick her with this notion that she's a radical. And so I think to a large extent in the public's mind, she is is an unknown. And so she has a chance, a rare chance, I think, for a politician to sort of write her own profile. And so it'll be interesting to see how she does that.
And we'll follow that on future editions of the On Iowa Politics podcast. But before we go today, I want to talk to Aaron a little bit about November 4th was a terrible, horrible, bad day for Iowa Democrats. In addition to losing the so-called Harkin seat, Republican Rod Blum scored a surprising win in the heavily Democratic 1st District. David Young held on to Tom Latham's 3rd District seat. The one bright spot for Democrats, Aaron, was the Iowa Senate, where they held on to their 26-24 majority. They didn't increase their majority, but I guess holding on to it, considering how the rest of the election went, was a victory in itself. And Republicans are in control in the Iowa House. Republican Governor Branstad won a 6th term, so he's at Terrace Hill for another 4 years. Aaron, how important is that Democratic majority in the Senate as sort of a firewall against Republican initiatives?
Well, I mean, from the Democratic perspective, it's absolutely critical. And I can tell you that the feeling was of great relief. I don't think they popped the champagne that night, but definitely breathed a huge sigh of relief from their perspective, from their caucus, knowing that they held on to that slim margin, if I remember right. And I apologize to everybody if I'm wrong, but I think one seat flipped on each side, so it wound up bouncing out to status quo. Otherwise, like you said, would have had a Republican majority in all three legs of that stool at the Capitol, and you would have seen a lot different types of legislation moving forward, a lot more conservative legislation that Democrats would have been absolutely helpless to stop, essentially. What I heard a lot from Democrats was their concern that it would have turned into Wisconsin version 2.0, referring to Governor Scott Walker and the all-Republican Wisconsin Assembly and some of the controversial legislation they've passed with stripping collective bargaining rights for public employees and other measures up there. So that was the silver lining in a very, very, very dark cloud for Democrats here in this election, that they were able to hold on to that majority in the Senate. And we have at least two more years of split control state government and all the negotiations and legislation that comes with that. I was just talking to someone else about this recently. I almost out of curiosity would have been interested to see all Republican control in the state house, just for no other reason than to see what kinds of legislation Terry Branstad would have supported. For these last few years, he's campaigned and talked a lot about him being a bipartisan governor. He's worked with a bipartisan state government, and he's been able to get things accomplished and kind of portrays that centrist role. It would have been very interesting to me personally to see what kinds of legislation he would have signed off on that came to his desk with all Republican control in both chambers.
That's a good question, because I almost think that in an all-Republican statehouse, that Terry Branstad might be the foot on the brake, you know, compared to some of the folks in the Iowa House, especially some of the legislative ideas they've put forward in the past, as well as the, you know, the Republicans in the Senate, a very conservative agenda. And I almost think that Branstad might be sort of dragging his feet on some of those things, being less like Governor Scott Walker than the legislators themselves. I don't know if there are other thoughts on that. We haven't had unified control very often in Iowa in recent years. In fact, I was one of, I think Aaron, maybe you know this, it's like four states where the legislature is split between Democrats and Republicans. In most states, one party or the other has control. And in a surprising number of states, the governor and both chambers of the legislature are in control of one party. So we're sort of an anomaly right now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Whatever the number is, I don't know off the top of my head, but you're right, it's very low, surprisingly low.
Yeah, I guess we assume the purple status, but it doesn't apply across the country. There are red states and blue states, and then there's Iowa. So, well, that's it for this edition of On Iowa Politics. I hope it was worth your time. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, tell your friends and subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher. You can find us every week on the home pages of the Quad City Times, Sioux City Journal, Muscatine Journal, Mason City Globe Gazette, Waterloo Courier, and the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Brotherhood of the Mudcat, a metal band from Cedar Rapids, will take us out today. If you know a band or a talented Iowa musician who should be on the show, drop us a line or send us a sound file. And remember to follow us on Twitter and subscribe to On Iowa Politics on iTunes and Stitcher. For Christinia, Ed, Aaron, and our producer Max, I'm James Lynch. Thanks for listening.